From 90.1 WFYI Public Radio, welcome to The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you, and from the Palladium at the Center for the Performing Arts. The music for today's show is courtesy of the Buscelli Wallerab Jazz Orchestra from their Heart and Soul album, available on iTunes.
I'm Sharon Gamble. Welcome to The Art of the Matter. This week, Prince's drummer, the Geeky Press, and Cabinets of Curiosities. And don't forget, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
You won't want to miss a word right after the latest news from NPR. Welcome back to The Art of the Matter from 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and later on today's program, a writer's collective that's on fire. But first, the original musical The Great Bike Race, a whimsical recounting of the disastrous second Tour de France, was a hit at the 2014 Indie Fringe Festival. Now, Zach Rosing Productions and writer-director Zach Neidich are bringing it back, this time as a full-length play. Zach and Zach talked about the evolution and expansion of the comedy and what's new at the races with contributor and Indianapolis Business Journal arts and entertainment editor Lou Harry.
Great Bike Race has the distinction of being a show that grew out of the Indie Fringe Festival. At what point in the game did you decide to biggie-size it?
Well, in the midst of selecting shows for Tatz's season, for this current season, we had another show planned, and then fate intervened on that one, and so we saw the opportunity to be like, hey, let us do The Great Bike Race. We weren't exactly expecting a yes, but we got a yes, and we're pretty excited to be able to do it now.
Mm-hmm. When that show was originally at Fringe, and that was, what, 3 years ago?
Yes.
Okay. 2014.
2014. I mean, that was an out-there concept. If you could just explain briefly what the gist is of The Great Bike Race.
Yes. So The Great Bike Race is a show that is based on true events of the second annual running of the Tour de France back in the 1900s. It was an article I had seen about the actual events where people, writers, they just started cheating and hurting each other and backstabbing and lying and just doing all of these things to make their way through the race and win. And eventually a lot of them got disqualified or fully banned from bicycling forever. And I just thought it was such a fun story, especially for the times that we were in. When I first started discovering these stories were all about Mr. Lance Armstrong. And so hearing that history made, I think, our current era of all of the cheating a little more accessible to see that it's just been happening forever.
And the look of that production was unique.
It was unique. So,
at what point does the look of an idea come in as you're writing and developing, or are those things happening on simultaneous tracks?
Well, for Bike Race, I mean, I had had the idea for a little while, and then when Zach and I had started working together, it was pretty evident that the idea would be great with a lot of Zach's video talents. So that's when I kind of came in and was like, what if we did this? And that's usually how Zach and I work, is I tell him what crazy thing I'd like to do on stage, and he...
I get a list, and then find out how little time I have to figure it out.
How to make my dreams come true.
Give us a visual. What, for instance, was something in that production that you had to figure out how to create?
We had to go and do a lot of kind of filming of trees and stuff for moving backgrounds and things like that. We did some green screen stuff, and we have some little bits that...
you know how to see certain things on stage that you wouldn't really be able to, kind of how to bring the film version of this story and put it on stage instead.
And especially with a Fringe production, you have to simplify and get in and out, and there's not time for lots of set and things like that. So being able to do video stuff lets us kind of exceed expectations, mm-hmm. I think, in a way that's still manageable for going in for 10 minutes of setup and being able to pull something off.
But, so, I mean, it was pretty remarkable for that, where a lot of Fringe shows are a person with a microphone, you know, or, you know, a couple of cubes on the ground. You guys were giving a full visual experience in there with a large cast.
Yeah. I think we always try to do that. Even on our smaller budget stuff, or if it's a Fringe show or whatever, I think we try to kind of exceed what people are expecting for a fringe production.
Yeah.
And even if the pieces are kind of low budget in and of themselves, we, I think, try to find a way, whether that's video, sound, or whatever, try to find a way to... Yeah, lift the production value of everything.
Yeah, and we're never one to aim small.
Now, was this something that in order to get it into the 50-55 minute Fringe show, you needed to trim stuff out, or was it that after Fringe, you wanted to do a full length piece, which is what you're doing? Are you writing new material? You know, how does that?
Well, I'm comfortable talking about it, but back in the Fringe, we had hit a moment where we were realizing, oh man, this is really, really short.
It was short at the time.
It didn't feel short. Yeah, but there's a lot of material and it all kind of runs really fast. Right. So we would block everything out. We did the whole show and then we realized it was about 40 minutes long. And it was like, oh no, we've got to do more. So we've fully filled up our time.
Closer to 50.
We got to about 50. But at that time, it was pulling teeth for me. Mm-hmm. I just couldn't tell you what more I could have put into this story. And then... You know, coming back to it with a good 2 years in between, seeing, oh man, I have so much that I could put in. Wow. And I just had all of these ideas of where to extend and what to pull out and what to add. And so it was a lot easier now, having taken some time away from the piece and getting to see it again with some fresher eyes.
How is it? Are some of the cast members returning?
Yes, we are about half and half, actually. Okay. We've got about 5 originals and 4 new people.
And what is that experience like, directing and working with a cast that, you know, most of the time a cast might have a script 3 weeks before production? Some of these people have been with the material for 2 years.
Yeah, and even for the people who have been in it, even for the originals, they will all have new stuff to do, and they will all have different curveballs being thrown. So we're just getting into the rehearsal process, and we're just kind of starting to step around and feel how that's all going to be. But I think everybody was really excited to kind of get back into it.
Right. What else is in the pipeline for what you're hoping to be able to do in the next year or two?
Well, we have a show coming up in the upcoming Fringe Festival. That'll be 2017. It'll be our 3rd Fringe show together, which is exciting.
Can you give us a hint of that?
It was our take on some morning television.
Okay.
It'll be a fun evening of morning television.
An evening of morning television.
An evening of morning television. We'll see it. It'll be fun.
Okay.
Expect some arguing and some big personalities and things like that.
Yeah.
And a number of video monitors, right?
Well, live TV, so you would expect there to be some element of video in it.
Yeah.
I don't think it would be a good Fringe show for us if we didn't have that. So
you got to be flashy.
And other work?
I know we have plans to bring Rocky Horror back at some point next year, probably.
Usually is around October, isn't it?
Yeah, not this year, but I think we're going to do that again next year. But kind of what happens between then and now, we'll wait and find out.
On the marketing side, is it different? The last time you did this show was during a festival where there was a percentage of people who were just going to the festival and then looking within that to see what they were going to go see. Mm-hmm. This is a freestanding show.
Yeah, Fringe is definitely kind of its own animal, so it's hard to say, oh, we did really well at Fringe, so we'll definitely do well this time. I don't think anyone makes that kind of assumption. And then especially us, that we're not really any sort of official company. We're just kind of, I think, project by project figuring things out. And so it's definitely something we have to consider that's made easier by being part of the Theater on the Square season. They have a built-in audience, but it's certainly something you got to think about when you're doing something that's kind of new and from scratch. You know, who's going to come see it? And it's a challenge.
We're constantly living and learning, learning from our own mistakes and growing.
Did you make the mistake of ditching all the props when you were done the last time you did, or do you still have the handlebars and the costume pieces?
The one place in my house I let myself hoard is in the attic in my garage, and so there's boxes from every show. There's probably some handlebars and stuff up there from bicycles and things, but...
after that Fringe was over, we did really well, and we really enjoyed ourselves of the bike race year, and so I always had it in my mind. Zach might have not had it in his mind as much, but I always had it in my mind that we were going to do the bike race again, and we were going to be able to come back to it and do more.
Lou Harry with Zach Rosing and Zach Neidich, creators of The Great Bike Race, which you can see at Theater on the Square June 9th through the 24th. You can find out more at tots.org. Indie Indiana Artists was founded as Indiana Artists Club in 1917 by 46 prominent Indiana visual artists, including such luminaries as T.C. Steele, William Forsythe, and Marie Goth. The organization is still vibrant and about to launch its board member exhibit. I invited Indiana Artists Board President James Hubbard, who's a printmaker, to tell me about the show.
A centennial board exhibit sounds like kind of high pressure.
Well, we produce work throughout the year, so we are ready to go with the board exhibit. That this is our centennial year in 2017, and we're adding this exhibit to our itinerary. On Saturday, it'll be from Saturday, June the 10th to Saturday, July the 1st at French Blue Gallery, 111 West Main Street in Carmel. Gallery hours are Wednesday through Saturday, 11 to 6, and the opening reception is Saturday, June the 10th from 5 to 9.
And is this exhibition adjudicated?
Meaning a jury? No. Mm-hmm. We have to be juried to be a part, to be a member of INA.
Okay.
So right up front, the membership is juried in, and then the board is elected. The president is elected every 2 years, and I'm the new president.
Congratulations.
Of INA.
Thank that you. Explains the crown and the scepter.
Right. And all of the salary that I get for this position.
Yeah. And see, keep your sense of humor in working in not for profits. That's important. So, how many members are there?
We have about 130 members currently. And there are so many opportunities for these members to show. We have the IMA show going on at the Indianapolis Museum of Art, and it closes on June the 11th. So that is a current opportunity for the public
That's
to see our work.
Fabulous show. I went over to look at that. Just a wide variety of styles in that show.
Thank you. Thank you. And then we have the Centennial Indiana Artists Board Exhibition at or not board exhibition, but members exhibition, also at Fishertown Hall, that's going on currently. That just opened this last Friday, and that will be going on from this week throughout June. It closes on June the 28th.
Mm-hmm.
So that's another opportunity. If you're in the Fishers area, stop by City Hall at 1 Municipal Drive in Fishers, and they're open from 8:30 to 4:30 p.m. every day.
Are there, so Indiana Artists has people who work in a wide variety of media.
Yes, I happen to be a printmaker. I work in block printing and copperplate etching, but we have painters that work in oil, acrylic, and watercolor. Pastel artists. We have artists that are photographers, darkroom photographers, as well as digital photographers. We have other printmakers that work in other media, such as silkscreen and lithography.
Do you have sculptors? Are sculptors allowed?
Well, sculptors are allowed in, but we have very few sculptors. So if you are a sculptor out there and you are interested in exhibiting with INA, and we do have two exhibits yearly, annually, that have lots of prize money, please consider becoming a member of INA. We are looking for sculptors. We like to see sculpture in the exhibits. But we're low on sculptors right now, so get your applications ready, because in October we will have another juried session where you will you need your exhibition record as well as three pieces of work that you would like to show us.
James Hubbard is board president of Indiana Artists, whose board member exhibit will open at Carmel's French Blue Gallery on Saturday, June 10th, and be on view through July 1st. You can learn more at indianaartists.org, and if you're one of those elusive sculptors, go to the Contact Us tab on that website. You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and later this hour, Prince's drummer, Bobby Z. But first, our state is home to what's billed as the largest scientifically organized independent wine competition in the United States. It features more than 2,000 wines from around the world, as Eat Drink Indie's Jolene Ketzenberger learned when she spoke with Christian Butzke, enology professor, chairman, and lead judge of the competition.
For people who might not know what the Indie International Wine Competition is, so explain briefly what the competition is and what it does.
Yes. So the concept of a wine competition is that there needs to be some independent way to make recommendations to consumers of how to buy wines, which wines are good, which ones are, you know, all right, which ones are super great. And so if you buy a copy of, let's say, Consumer Reports, you look for an independent opinion on whatever your vacuum cleaner or washing machine, because there's a bunch of stuff out there. And if you only follow the advertising, or if you only, in the case of wine, follow the label, then you're missing out on maybe being able to know what the wine might taste like, and if it is in the style that you personally prefer. I always say, you know, it's like buying shoes in a closed box with a picture of the shoe on the outside. So you wouldn't go to a, let's say, DSW and buy the shoe just from looking at it. Of course, people nowadays do. They do it online, and then they send the pair back if it doesn't fit or doesn't look good. But you know, ideally, you look at a piece of clothing and you try it on, and if you like it, if you feel you look good in it, then you buy it. And so with wine, you can't do that. You can't go in the store and open a bottle and taste it. You know, maybe if you had a bunch of Coravins hanging around and you could do that, but you don't. And so as a result, some guidance from other folks is helpful. If you buy glossy magazines like people would do in the olden days, or if you read a wine book, then, you know, you can certainly get opinions from people, from a very limited number of people, and from, of course, magazines that are influenced by the amount of advertising that people place in it, and how the wine writers are treated when they visit the winery and all those different things. And a lot of times the stories that are being told that they're then recording, which is the traditional way of people writing about wine, writing books, they're just recording the stories that are that they're being told, which in a lot of cases are, you know, have a lot to do with fantasies and myth and marketing and all of this.
So a wine competition fills the void that all of that might have filled for people.
Yes. So getting an independent opinion on wines, that's where wine competitions came in, a little bit like the Olympic Games. You know, that's how we give away, you know, bronze, silver, gold medals. You want to find out who is the best and who is really good, and you want to see all this. And you do that every now and then. But then again, this competition was founded 26 years ago, before the internet, before people had email, before social media, and it filled, again, a void between glossy magazines, wine books, articles you would read in an in-flight magazine, or just going into the wine shop or listening to what a sommelier recommends. So you would have something you... In the olden days, it would be a brochure that you look at, and you look up which wines won, and then you would go out and try to find those wines. Nowadays, the results of the Indie are being used on the winery's social media. They tweet about, you know, winning a trophy, or they post on Facebook which wine won a medal, and that allows them to promote the wines. It allows them to raise the price if there's more demand. But it also, and I'm a former winemaker, as a winemaker have won many of those medals, it's reassurance that you're doing a good job, much like winning a medal at the Olympics. You know, that is great. You win something, you're really happy. You think, oh, I'm doing something good, because otherwise, other than maybe sales numbers, you usually don't get that reassurance if you're a winemaker. People write articles about it and all that. But this is a nice way to really send in your entire portfolio of wines and get some feedback from those folks here, the 50 judges that I have this year that are really quite representative of the general public.
You can hear Jolene Ketzenberger's Eat, Drink, Indie Saturday mornings at 11 on WFYI HD2, The Point. You're tuned to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. It's been just over a year since the death of music icon Prince, and now one of his most popular backup bands, The Revolution, is touring the country celebrating his music. WFYI's Jill Dittmeyer got to find out lots more.
I did, Sharon. The Revolution played the Vogue in the middle of May, but just before that show, I talked on the phone with drummer Bobby Z about their tour. Drummer Bobby Z is one of the five members of The Revolution, and he says after a year of mourning, it was time for the band to get back on stage.
Grief has turned into expression and needing to express ourselves. And the only way to kind of conjure him back up is create these sounds and songs and feelings that his music creates.
He says the first time the band played the song Purple Rain without Prince was brutally raw.
It felt like slow motion. My hands were just playing the song. It's almost a dirge in itself.
Even though it's been nearly 25 years since Prince's music topped the charts, it has a timeless quality.
A lot of music in pop culture is just 2-4 or 4-4. Everything's just pretty simple. But with Prince, there was so much activity in even the simplest beat. He played with notes the way a mathematician may play with numbers. Things would be accented a little bit differently. And every listen with a Prince record, you can hear a little bit something different, a little bit more depth or something you didn't realize.
Bobby Z misses Prince both as a musician and a friend.
You know, we were very unfamous together, being friends and hanging out and just having a laugh or enjoying a film. Because to this day, it's like, would he like that film? Would he like that book? Would he like that TV show? There's just something etched in my DNA now that has his smile and laughter. And he was quite fond of laughter.
Do you think that you and the rest of the band will move forward and create your own music and perform? Or is this just going to be celebration of what you all had together with Prince?
Well, I think for quite a while it's going to be a celebration of what we had with Prince. It's there's a lot of different configurations and a lot of different bands and musicians he played with, and we just happened to be the musicians on, you know, 1999, Purple Rain, Around the World in a Day and Parade, and you know, these are songs that are timeless, and we want to just play them and interact and have them come alive still for quite a while. I mean, there's a lot of unreleased material we'd like to keep first before we do anything new, but we're certainly enjoying playing these songs for a live audience.
The Revolution is made up of guitarist Wendy Melvoyan, bassist Brown Mark, and the keyboard players Lisa Coleman and Dr. Fink. And Sharon, the tour actually started as a one-night performance. It was the night to celebrate Prince back at Paisley Park. But then they added a couple of dates, and Bobby Z said, and then they added a couple of more. And they had no idea that the reception from the fans was going to be as intense as it has been.
Wow.
Nor did they know that they were going to enjoy it so much themselves. So they are touring the Midwest for quite a while, and I wouldn't be surprised if they come back through Indiana once again.
Stay tuned. We'll tell you about it when they do.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Fantastic. Well, we have music and some other lovely things coming up on our calendar today that we call
What'll We Do?
Speaking of music, during the years when Dan Wakefield lived in New York City, well, he came out of it with a great book called New York in the 50s, but he also got to know amazing people, including conductor, composer, and multi-instrumentalist David Amram. And there are a couple of opportunities to sit down with those two fellas coming up on Sunday, June 4th, David Amram will be hosted by Dan Wakefield at the Jazz Kitchen. And the following night, it's Uncle Dan's Story Hour, but this time don't go to the Red Key because that's been moved to the Jazz Kitchen. That is Monday night, June 5th, moved to the Jazz Kitchen because we think this is going to be one of the more popular ones. So you can go hang out with Dan Wakefield and David Amram one or maybe even both nights.
If you're still looking for something fun to do on Memorial Day, Monday, May the 29th, you can head to the Indiana State Museum. In the Great Hall and the auditorium, they have some special programs going on. There will be a Civil War medicine show starting at noon, and then something called Chow Time, which might be interesting to see what's on the menu and who gets to wash the dishes afterwards. That starts at 1 o'clock. And then you get to tour the wartime kitchen at 2, and then there will be puppet making all day, all about wartime heroes, and an Indy and Anna cartoon will also be playing all day as well. So a nice way to remember our veterans by some hands-on activities at the Indiana State Museum on Monday.
Summertime means road trips, and you don't these days generally have to remember to throw your camera in the car or on the back of your bike with you, because most people have a phone with the ability to take pictures. If you'd like to get better at taking those pictures, you might want to listen up to this event. It's coming up in Newcastle on Saturday, June 3rd at 7 in the evening. It's called a smartphone photography workshop at the Golden Hour. The Golden Hour is that time when the day fades into night, and James Moriarty is going to help you learn how to take the best advantage of that time of day and work with the phone on your smartphone. You can find out more at MoriartyMedia.com, and that's where you can register, MoriartyMedia.com. Again, it's in Summit Lake State Park in Newcastle on June 3rd. The fee's just $10, and you're going to get admission to the park, a color-printed handout with lots of instructions, and a box of photographic clip-on lenses for your smartphone.
At the Circle City Industrial Complex, that's that big turquoise building over there on Brookside Avenue, just off of 10th Street and Mass Ave. In the Switzer Gallery, that's upstairs in the North Building, painter Jenna Pianke is going to be having an exhibit there through the month of June. She received a grant from the Indiana Arts Commission, and her work is all about Indiana's original canal path as it exists today. So she has been out looking at that and painting her interpretation of it. There'll be a little sneak peek on Thursday, June the 1st, and then First Friday, of course, is June the 2nd, and the Circle City Industrial Complex is open, all the galleries, from 6 to 10. And then you can do a little Q&A with Jenna at the end of the month on June the 24th from 2 to 6 p.m. She'll be talking more about her work, Lost Connections, at the Circle City Industrial Complex. And you can always learn more about local arts events at indiearts.org/guide. That's the Arts Council of Indianapolis's Indie Arts Guide. Or you can join us next week when we look at our calendar that we call What'll We Do?
You're listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in Indianapolis and central Indiana. Your host is Sharon Gamble. If your arts organization has an event or activity of which you think we should be aware, please contact us at least 3 weeks in advance. You can write us at The Art of the Matter, care of WFYI, 1630 North Meridian Street, Indianapolis, Indiana, 46202, or you can email us at aotm@wfyi.org. You can also hear The Art of the Matter on WFYI.org.
You're listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and in just a bit, where do you keep your collection of curiosities? Everyone should have one, and a place to store it, too. But right now, if you're a writer in central Indiana, you either know about the writer's collective known as the Geeky Press, or you should. The Geeky Press holds writer's retreats and readings, does a podcast called the Downtown Writer's Jam, publishes a literary magazine, and so much more. The Art of the Matter contributor Mark Allen sat down with the Geeky Press's Brad King to talk about all the things he and the Geeky Press do.
We should start with an introduction. So explain Geeky Press. How old is it? Where did it come from? What you been doing?
So I came to Indianapolis about 8 years ago. And at the other cities that I'd lived in, Austin, San Francisco, always had these big writing centers, these places where people could write. And we have the Indiana Writer Center up in Broad Ripple, but there wasn't anything downtown and where you could gather with writers and do things. So I literally just started this about 2.5 years ago, hosting readings over at Indy Reads Books. And they were popular. We had 70 or 80 people showing up for the readings, and kind of built from there and added three other partners along the way. So there's four of us now who do a variety of things. We host readings, we do writing retreats, we publish books, and we're doing our first literary magazine, which is coming out on May 19th.
So what's the state of writing in Indianapolis?
It's interesting because when Emily Taylor took over at Nouveau, she covers literary arts there. She said, I know there's a lot of stuff going on here, but there's not really a place where it's all gathered up. And I said, yeah, I've had the same problem. And as we've started doing things, we've found we have more than 350 people on our list. We've had about 150 writers participate in our events, either as readers or at the retreats. We had about 100 submissions for the literary magazine. When we do our anthology books, we've had more than 200 submissions to both of them. So there are a lot of people that are in various states of their career. You know, everything from new writers to mid-career folks to people like me who've doing it professionally for, you know, 20 years. So there is a lot of folks who are not only writing, but who are interested in sort of gathering and meeting other writers and producing things across all kinds of genres. What's interesting, I think, with the Geeky Press is that we've gone out of our way to, we have playwrights. There's a huge theater playwriting scene here. We've gone out and gotten a bunch of folks from the improv comedy because they write on stage, right? Like they don't put it on a page, but what they're doing is writing. Along with traditional fiction and nonfiction and poetry folks. So we have a really diverse group of people, and we're moving into the, this may seem odd, but we are moving into the spoken word as well, which is not that different from improv in that a lot of it is, it's written, but it's still performed, and it is meant to be live writing. So there's a lot of stuff happening. You can do something around the literary arts pretty much every day of the week here.
That's pretty amazing because I don't think of us necessarily that way, but maybe you're encouraging it, right? Is that what's happening?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's I talked to Brian Payne, who's over at CICF a few times, and I said, man, and in the Arts Council of Indianapolis, Shannon and Dave, and I said, you know, we do a really good job with visual arts, we do a really good job with music. But the space for writing isn't, it hasn't been carved out in the same kind of way. And we actually work with Shannon and Dave over the Arts Council now. Like we have a joint happy hour where we bring our writers together with their visual artists to try to get that cross-pollination going. So I think that the problem has been not that people didn't want to write or that they didn't want to gather, was that there weren't really a group of writers taking ownership of doing that. So you had the library doing, you know, bringing folks in, and you had the theater folks sort of existing in their space. But there wasn't a lot of, let's bring all this together. Mm-hmm. And really, that has been our superpower at the Geeky Press. And as I've gone out and gotten partners, I've looked for people who are different than me. I've looked for people that are in different genres that do different stuff than I do, because that's how you make it work.
Yeah. And you do a lot of different events. So let's talk about a few things that you do. One of them, the literary magazine. So that's new?
Yeah.
Tell me about that.
So May 19th is our first issue. And we, you know, I sort of have a mantra in life, which is make a thing. Like if you want something to exist, you got two choices, right? You can either hope somebody comes up with that or you can do it. And so
what about complain? You can complain, too.
I find that other people tend to tell us what we've done wrong, which is fine. Like that's right. part of making things right, is creating these conversations around stuff. So the literary magazine, you know, we're working with Bouch Books Indie. So that's Jessica Dyer, who works with small presses and takes books and puts together these pop up bookstores. And she and Nicole Matthew, who's one of our partners, did the poetry section. Elise Lockwood, who is involved in theater, did our, got our playwrights. And Amber Peckham and I worked on the fiction and nonfiction. So we just decided, like, we're just going to put this call out and see what happens. What's the worst that can happen? Like, if nobody shows up, we don't have a magazine. And it turns out we had, you know,
you have
about 150. Yeah, we had a, and we've already started getting submissions for fall. So we're kind of freaking out because we have to read all these and organize them. And, you know, it's a loose configuration of folks that do this. But my old boss used to call that a high class problem. Right. Okay. So we do that. And that's sort of an offshoot of these anthology books that we do. So we actually also publish books where we pick a topic and say, submit stuff. So I can't give you the title of the first one, but it was Bad Jobs and BS. and it was essentially just people writing stories, you know, fiction, poetry, nonfiction, plays about terrible jobs and awful things that happen to them.
You do retreats for writers, and they can be a day-long mm-hmm. thing. That was the one that I went to. But you also have a weekend-type thing, too.
We do. We do monthly, like, 1 to 2 hour events at coffee shops just to get people together. They're called writing hacks. We do quarterly writing retreats, and we've done them for a day, so like 8:30, 9:30 to 4:30. We're going to start doing them half days because we feel like that is I like to write for 8 hours, but it turns out most people have lives, and about 4 hours is a good amount of time for them. And we've done them, you know, we did one at the Columbia Club. We did one at the Speakeasy. We just kind of like bounce around in places that are quiet where we can have space. And then we do a yearly writing retreat down at Bradford Woods. That's 3 days.
Yeah, and you've made these really affordable, I think. I mean, I think the event I went to cost all of
$10.
$10. And I know that retreat is $95,
yeah.
Right? So very much affordable.
Yeah, the nice – well, I mean, it's not a business, right? So, like, if we cover costs, I'm happy. On the writing retreats, I cover most of the costs. Like, I pay for a little bit of that, but – that's, you know, if you're going to make something like that, we're trying to build a community and not trying to make money off the community.
Brad King with contributor Mark Allen. The Geeky Press's literary magazine Hoosier Lit is out now. More about the Geeky Press is available at thegeekypress.com. Renaissance England, there was a craze for owning cabinets of curiosities, and the trend flowed from the rich down to the rest of us. The term curio cabinet still holds some magic, as the Indianapolis Art Center's Kyle Harrington discovered when he put out a call for entries for a show called Curio Cabinet. I love the name Curio Cabinet. Let's start there. Where did that come from?
Oh, geez. Well, so this was an idea I had for a show for a while now.
Yeah.
I'm thinking back to the artist Bruce Nauman, actually, who has the piece about, you know, the true artist reveals mystic truth.
Mm-hmm.
So this was sort of an idea that I had in terms of artists not necessarily straight shooting with their themes and with their concepts and leaving a little bit of intrigue and mystery behind their work, letting the viewer figure out sort of the meat of the piece.
Wow.
So there was a lot of entry points into the show in terms of theme, and I was really thinking about that word curiosity.
Mm-hmm.
And that really lent itself to this idea of a curio cabinet. And what is art but sometimes a thing that people kind of sit and look at and ponder?
Mm-hmm.
And you think back to, you know, classical curio cabinets, which is sort of a container for all of these objects of wonder and mystery and intrigue. And so I sort of started thinking of our gallery spaces as a curio cabinet and me wanting to fill it with all of these, for lack of a better term, objects of intrigue and mystery.
Yeah.
So that's kind of where that stemmed from.
Yeah. I love that. And I love the idea, too, a curio cabinet, if you happen to have had one at your house or your museum, was quirky because it depended upon the sensibility of the person doing the collecting, right?
Right, right. And I think that it's a really good vehicle for me to have a wide range of work. A lot of times, you know, it's not just a themed sort of thing. It's kind of, you know, for lack of a better term, a receptacle for all these different knickknacks and things that are based on the interest of the owner of this curio cabinet. So it really has allowed me to cast a huge net in terms of the type of work and the types of artists that are showing in this exhibition.
How did you get, you put out a call for entries. How did you get that word out?
Yes. I've been lucky enough in the city to meet a lot of different types of people. And something that I love about the Art Center itself is the you know, huge scope of types of artists that I'm able to work with. I work with people that are in the academic world. I work with emerging artists. I work with, you know, what you might call hobbyists. I have a really wide network of different types of artists, and I wanted to leverage that into participation in the show. So a lot of it was word of mouth. Of course, I always work with the Arts Council to get our calls out with their e-newsletter, which is
sure.
a great resource that the city has. And then really social media, I'm finding that this really is helping me spread a lot of the calls calls and the information about what we're doing at the Art Center.
And people responded. How many entries did you get?
We had 500, over 500 pieces were entered, and I was really happy about that.
Give me some context for that. Is that that sounds high to me.
Yes, yes. I would say, you know, anytime you're doing an open show like this, it's always a bit of a risk because you're really beholden to the entries and the interest that you get. So you can have this grand idea, and the turnout can kind of be, for lack of a better word, disappointing sometimes. So I was very floored and excited when I got so much interest with this theme.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that having 500 pieces to pick from was tough because I have to take space into consideration too. So, you know, I've got just under 70 pieces, and I've got pieces that are 6 foot long paintings. And then I've got, of course, these really small, intimate, intricate pieces too. So it's really exciting to me to have that pool of possibilities, but it's also really tough because I want to show everything.
Any limitation on medium?
No, it was wide open, which I'm also glad that we really did. You know, I've done shows in the past where I've really had this sort of laser focus on, okay, well, this is about this particular medium or this is about this particular concept. But I really wanted to have a show, you know, that was accepting everybody and that I was able to really cherry pick a lot of these different types of work into a sort of a cohesive exhibition rather than really hyper-focused, like, this is the type of work that it is. There's so many different entry points to this exhibition.
So take us through, you haven't installed the show yet because
No. You're,
as we're having this conversation, you've taken a break from getting ready for the Broad Ripple Art Fair. bless your heart. But so you have all these works. Now you have to decide, so what order do they go in? And it's not like you're hanging traditional art where you might do a chronological order or, mm-hmm. you know, this artist's influence on this other one. What was your entry point for deciding how to hang?
Well, that's something that's a lot of people actually do ask me about. You know, how do we plan out the installation of our exhibits and sort of laying out where the pieces go in the galleries?
Yeah.
And for me, it's incredibly intuitive. I don't pre-plan any of the layout until I get all the physical artwork there,
really? Which
can be a little bit of a boon when it comes to seeing the actual work and getting it in person. But I find that I personally, you know, my background is in, I started as an artist more so than a curator. So for me, laying out a show is sort of like the creative part of the artist in me, which is reacting in real time to those pieces and letting those pieces have a dialogue with each other.
Mm.
Something else that I noticed is that it's really difficult to read the presence of a piece in a digital image. So I do wait until we get all of that stuff, you know, into the building, and I get to see the physical objects and see how they speak to each other and see, you know, how they kind of give this journey to the viewer through the exhibition. So a lot of it is on the spot, kind of reacting and very intuitive.
Does your gut lead you to the first piece that you're going to put up or display?
I would say generally, I mean, when I'm installing any kind of show or laying it out, I do look for sort of like a showstopper piece in terms of like what, you know, if I had to do a postcard for the exhibition, what's the piece on the cover of the postcard?
Yeah.
What's really the image or the experience that you want people to take away from the show? And that is able to have me inform the rest of the spaces through that piece. And because there's certain pieces that piece will work with, and then there's other pieces that, you know, respond differently to that. So
here is a total layman question. I'm walking into a gallery space. Will I know whether you want me to start on the left side, in the middle, on the right side? Is there an entry point that you envision the viewer having and an exit point that you envision the viewer having?
For me and for the Art Center, I'd say no. We do have a lot of different actual, you know, physical entry points to the building. So
yeah.
Some person can start on the east end. Some person can start on the south end of the building and make their way through the exhibit. You know, I'm not necessarily interested in the traditional sense of exhibition layout and kind of having a flow in this order through an exhibition. So what I like to do is create these different vignettes of activity. and of dialogue within the art itself, and let the viewer really explore the exhibition organically. Mm-hmm. I don't want to force anything down anyone's throat in terms of this is the order that it must be seen. And I think that opens me up to a lot of possibility, and it lets me be a lot more playful than I normally otherwise couldn't be, because I really get to take a bird's eye view of the whole thing and think about these really nuanced pairings throughout the show and have them respond organically to each other.
Tell me about the most surprising interpretation of the curio cabinet theme.
I would say that something that I really noticed was there's a lot of play on technology, which was something that I was not thinking about immediately. One of the paintings that we got is this 6-foot-long painting of a gentleman laying in bed looking at an iPhone with the glow of the phone screen looking on his face. And that just blew me away because I thought, you know what? Phones are like curio cabinets now. You're sitting there and you're going through all of these different articles and pictures and viral things. And I just thought that was so cool. I thought it was such an apt take on the theme, but very relevant to where the world is at today. So that was really cool because in my mind I was thinking sort of more traditional physical curio cabinets. And it's cool when an artist can sort of open my eyes to a viewpoint of this concept that I had not seen before.
Kyle Harrington is the Indianapolis Art Center's Director of Exhibitions and Events. The Curio Cabinet Exhibition displays nearly 70 works by 52 artists at the Indianapolis Art Center, and it opens June 9th. Every week, a Cultural Manifesto's Kyle Long talks 5 songs with someone from our community. Here's this week's journey.
I'm Kyle Long from Cultural Manifesto. I'm here with guitarist Ryan Taylor of the Indianapolis Jazz Quartet Premium Blend. Premium Blend have a new record out. It's titled The Road, and you can go to premiumblendindie.com for more information. And Ryan, I put you on the spot to come up with 5 songs really fast. Are these 5 favorite songs? How would you define this?
These are tunes that I listen to on a regular basis for inspiration.
Great. What is your first tune of inspiration for us today?
It's a composition, Herbie Hancock, entitled Actual Proof off the Thrust record. And the connection for this tune is the mayor of Indianapolis Jazz, Rob Dixon, works with Mike Clark, who was the drummer on this record. And I've gotten him to regale me with the story about this track. And it's just very interesting because there's an underlying Buddhist concept with the term actual proof. So I think it's not only a vivid example of Herbie's genius, but also it was sort of Mike Clark's breakthrough, as it were. And so that's the significance of actual proof.
And your second pick.
This is it's a reggae track entitled Bushweed Corn Trash by Ricky and Bunny. They're affiliated, of course, with the Wailers. It's a minor reggae tune, and I had it on a cassette tape that I got, I think, at like a gas station when I was like maybe 15 years old. And it's very hypnotic. It sounds like summertime even in winter. So Bushweed and Corn Trash by Ricky and Bunny. This is the apex of jazz guitar improvisation, Impressions by Wes Montgomery, as played at the Half Note for the record, Smoking at the Half Note with the Wynton Kelly Trio. And I think it's any guitarist that has not transcribed this and spent hours with this recording, it's tough for me to call their education complete. This fourth track, the quality of the recording is not terrific, but it's the definitive Bud Powell improvisation and his sort of signature piece is entitled Tea for Two, and it's at a blistering tempo, and it's sort of it's a catalog of all his sort of melodic ideas and Charlie Parker inspired, you know, linear improvisation.
Final piece, Ryan.
This tune, no matter when you hear it, whether you're in a restaurant, whether it's live on the radio, whatever moment of your life you hear this tune, it never gets old. It's a very modern sort of soul sound by the Detroit Spinners entitled I'll Be Around.
As I mentioned, you're the guitarist for Premium Blend. You have a new record out with Premium Blend. It's titled The Road. Anything you want to say about this album?
Big thanks to Stephen Jones, Brian Yard, of course, our band leader, Jared Thompson, Matt Weiss, Dan Porter. And I would say listen to this record with an open mind. We attempted to sort of achieve a synthesis of street elements of music, hip-hop, R&B, and, of course, straight-ahead jazz. So we hope you like it.
And Ryan, folks can catch you out live Wednesday nights at Merrow in Fountain Square with Premium Blend. And Sunday nights, you have your trio at the Chatterbox down on Mass Ave. Is that right?
That's correct. And it's also a jam session for competent, you know, young jazz musicians who are seeking to refine their skills. Come one, come all, you're welcome.
Yeah, and check out the new record at premiumblendindie.com. Thanks a lot, Ryan. Appreciate it.
Hear Kyle's A Cultural Manifesto on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio Wednesday nights at 8 or Saturday nights at 10. Thanks for listening to The Art of the Matter on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio. I'm Sharon Gamble, and today's contributors included Mark Allen, Jill Dittmeyer, and Lou Harry. Hear The Art of the Matter Saturday mornings at 7 or join us Thursday nights at 8. And remember, you can always listen to and share our podcast at WFYI.org. Next week, the Talbot Street Art Fair, top-rate jazz, and early music. And, of course, we'll have that arts calendar we call
What'll We Do?
All of that and so much more on The Art of the Matter here on 90.1 WFYI Public Radio.
You've been listening to The Art of the Matter, a weekly show about the arts in central Indiana and Indianapolis. The Art of the Matter is executive producer Roxana Caldwell, producer Melissa Davis, contributor Jill Dittmeyer, and host Sharon Gamble. The Art of the Matter, made possible by the ongoing support of listeners like you.